All right, the second case we're going to hear today is U.S. versus Chandia. And Mr. Miller, when you're ready, we'll hear from you.
Good morning. Please report. I'm Marvin Miller on behalf of Mr. Chandia.
We're here, third time, same issue, sentencing. First time the court imposed the terrorism enhancement without any explanation, without ruling on defense objections. The second time the court imposed the terrorism enhancement without ruling on objections, but did make findings of fact, which were essentially that he had provided material support to LET and that he knew who they were and what they were doing when he did so. And this court has said twice in Chandia 1 and Chandia 2 that the basic facts of conviction are insufficient to support a terrorism enhancement in this case because there were no acts of violence. The conspiracy was a conspiracy, as the court instructed the trial jury, to damage property, not to harm people. And LET then, and that time in 2001 and 2, was an organization focusing on India's occupation of Kashmir, which was mostly Muslim, in violation of the 1947 mandate, not holding a vote and so on. Now, Mr. Chandia, school teacher, scholar, and academic, was considered by those in a core group that had been involved in AK-47s at the range, playing paintball and stuff like that, as to not be part of their group, and that was their testimony to the jury. They said he was a wimp to the FBI. They told the jury he was not physical. He was not told about these activities, wasn't party to these activities, and we didn't want him around. Some of those guys went to Pakistan. One of them was Hassan, who had family in Lahore, and he went and visited his family. He's joined by Kwan. Those guys then go to an LET training camp in, I think it's October 2001. Chandia, before 9/11, has planned to go to Pakistan, where his father's a prominent lawyer in Lahore. His brother's getting married, his daddy's having a thyroid operation. He tells his boss, Mr. Allen, who's not looking for a sentence reduction, doesn't have a business that could be in trouble for selling materials to a terrorist organization. He's just the guy that works at Costco. He says, my employee, Chandia, before Labor Day in 2001, told me he was going to Pakistan for family business. And then Chandia, and the testimony is undisputed, it takes a month to get a passport when you're that young from Pakistan. So he picked up his passport on the 15th of October, which means that he had to have ordered it sometime around mid-September. And that's consistent with what he told his boss he was doing. When he's over there, he goes by happenstance to an LET office. Now, LET has its office in Lahore. They have offices elsewhere in Pakistan as well. And when Hassan and Kwan are looking for the LET office, they just ask some guy on the street, goes, hey, where's the LET office? Oh, you go here, you go there, and there it is. It was open, it was public, it was well-regarded, and it was not designated by anybody to be a terrorist organization then. In November, when Chandia is there and goes in, the government witnesses say that they happened to meet in the office by happenstance, by chance. No plan, no organization, just they happened to find him there. Hassan, who's got family in Lahore, gets help from Chandia to get a taxi to his aunt's house. Kwan sees him first at the same time with Hassan, then he changes his mind, says, no, I met him at separate time, but it was also unplanned. And where had those guys been before they were at the office? They had been at the camps. They had secretly gone to get involved in that activity, and Chandia was not part of their crew. They didn't allow him to know what was going on. The camps were shut down. Why? Our forces went into Afghanistan. They were rolling up the Taliban. They shut down the camps, and they moved Kwan, Hassan, and Masood Khan to their facility at Maridke, which is schools, hospital, and all kinds of things like that. And that's where those three guys are. When Chandia happens to see them, happen to be in the office. Hassan is leaving. He's going to his aunt's house. Kwan is there for a little bit. and Quan and he have a conversation, two and a half hours. During that entire conversation, there is two mentions of anything. Is it hard? Yes. And it's cold. You need warm clothing. That's it. No one ever said that he had any interest in, expressed any interest in to them or anybody they knew about going to a camp to train for anything. And the camps were closed.
Why don't you address the district court's findings of when the defendant, when Shandia came back from Pakistan and met up with Quan. Quan had his telephone number, and he assisted Quan in going to Vesta in Colorado to purchase arms.
Well, let's talk
and
about
they had the emails, and they had the conversations, and they had the assistance, and they had the cautions about being caught and this type of thing.
When Muhammad Ajmal Khan came to the U.S., he did go to Colorado. The judge found that he...
Well, I'm talking about even before that. He went to Colorado with specific and direct assistance of Shandia.
Not really.
His telephone number, that was his first contact. And
he had his telephone number.
Had the.
And when he went there, he didn't give it. The judge found that he gave him the exact address where he was staying, but that's not true. He gave him an address that was at a Super 8 motel and then stayed at an American motel, not the same place. So what happened there is he misdirected him as where he was staying when he was in Colorado. And he never told him what he was doing or why he was there. The individuals who were involved with the planes, the remote control, the camera, were Chapman and Masood Khan. None of that had anything to do with Shandia. He wasn't involved in that at all. They were the ones who paid for it. They were the ones who got reimbursed. They were the ones who used their addresses for shipping all of that stuff. And the only thing Shandia did was give him a ride to the airport. And he had the phone number, and he allowed him access to the computer. But as this court has said twice before, that kind of material might be material support, but it is not evidence of his specific intent to engage in violence. He never wrote or said anything at any time about violence to anyone, anywhere. There's no evidence that he knew what Ajmal Khan was doing in Colorado. Khan didn't get a plane there. When he did deal with it, he didn't deal with it.
He was told that there was LET business.
No, he wasn't.
I'm looking at page 848. You don't think that finding's clearly erroneous? Testified from the conversation, I understood that he, Khan, was here for LET business.
Yes,
that's
let's
the conversation that the defendant was told in the driveway.
Let's talk about that conversation as this court characterized it in Shandia 2, where this court said in its opinion that Hassan testified he knew Khan, which is true. He knew Khan was associated with LET, which is true. He assumed, for reasons he never expressed or explained, that Khan was here on LET business. Hassan did not testify that Khan said in Shandia's presence that Khan was in the United States on LET business. And Hassan never made
this
any statement.
This is a finding of fact that's on remand. The court makes. And
right.
The question is, it clearly erroneous?
It's clearly erroneous because the evidence doesn't support it, because when this court read the transcript of Hassan's testimony and put it in its findings of fact in Shandia 2.
We don't find facts. We report what the record shows.
You were reporting what the record showed, and the record showed that Khan...
Just a minute.
Yes, sir.
Now the district court, we remanded it. The district court makes an explicit finding that in that driveway, they had that conversation, and that the defendant and Khan on the driveway, his parents' home, and testified from the conversation, I understood that he, Khan, was here for LET business.
If you read the record of that transcript of that conversation.
Well,
that conversation does not support the court's findings.
Well, direct me to it.
In Hassan's testimony, he says, as this court reflected in its decision, and this is in the record from page 247 of the joint appendix of the prior appeal. They're in the driveway of the parents' house talking.
No, you don't have any reference to this appendix?
That conversation, I do not believe, is in this appendix, but this court recounted that conversation and the transcript of it in Shandia 2. And Hassan said that they had a conversation. He never said in Shandia's presence that he thought that Khan was here for LET business. Khan never mentioned LET. Hassan never mentioned LET. They never said why he was here. There was no statement to that effect whatsoever. The court doesn't reference the transcript, and the court is absolutely clearly erroneous in that finding because Hassan never said it. And there's no statement where he ever said why he thought Muhammad Ajmal Khan was here. He never expressed a reason for his assumption. He just said it was an assumption.
You agree? Does the record show that Shandia and Khan had various communications where they kept a low profile and the messages were cryptic?
They were not cryptic. They were email messages, and there was nothing cryptic about it. If you look at, that's a generational gap. With all due respect, I'm part of that generational gap myself. But the point of it is, there was nothing cryptic about it at all. I want your phone number, he says in one email in June. But he didn't get the phone number. He didn't have the phone number.
Did he know that Khan was going to Vesta?
No. Where's the information about that? There's no one who ever said so. No.
Did he know that Khan needed money at Vesta to buy materials?
No. What happens is Khan sends an email, says, please send money, gives him the wrong address. Shandia responds, thanks, and as Mr. Gibbs...
Or gives him a cover address.
No. He gives him no address where he is.
He's not where he is, where to send the money.
There's no money is ever sent. There's no evidence that any money was ever sent, and there's no record of any money being sent or received, and there's no record that he knew why he was there. They didn't trust Shandia. That's why when the paintballs didn't go through, Shandia didn't know who had the paperwork and didn't have the paperwork himself. He wasn't allowed to have Khan's phone number. Even when he asked for it, it wasn't given to him. When the paintballs were shipped over, they were never received. They went to an office, and as Mr. Gibbs told this court last time, they never went anywhere after that. There is no evidence that Shandia knew what was going on with any of that equipment because he wasn't in the loop for it. That was Chapman and Masood Khan, and that's what the evidence shows. There's also the court made findings, but the facts don't support it. The court made conclusions that he was told things and nobody said anything about that. There's no testimony to it. There's no telephone call record. There's no money record. There's nothing at all like that. And there's no way that there's anyone who claimed that if I'm staying at the Holiday Inn, you can send money to the Marriott and I'll get it. And no money was sent. It didn't happen. Those facts the court found are not supported by the record. And the court, in the first instance, found that Hassan had made these statements, but the transcript shows he did not. And it's clear he did not. The court also committed error in violating Rule 32 because right after the court pronounced its findings on the guideline, it said, Mr. Shandia, come to the podium. Do you have anything you wish to say? Mr. Shandia said no, and the court launched into sentencing. It gave the defense no opportunity to address the court, A, on the mistakes it made in the record about things like the motel where he said it was the exact address. That was what the court said. It used the word exact address. It was wrong. There was no evidence. There was no opportunity to correct the court about the paintballs being released because they weren't, because Mr. Gibbs, as he advised this court at the last oral argument, said they didn't know what happened to them afterwards. That's at page 27 of the oral argument transcript. This court provided guidance to the lower court about the enhancement and talked about Hamoud, where the defendant who got the enhancement admitted that he was advocated and believed in violence in his testimony, and the co-defendant who did the same thing but made no admission did not get the enhancement. The court did not address the issue of disparity either, even though this court in Saeed to Ben Kala had referenced that.
Let me sit down, and you can take a look at this. At page 159 of the transcript, Mr. Hassan describes that conversation in the driveway, and that was with Khalid, Hassan, and the defendant, Shandia. And in that conversation, Hassan says, from the conversation, I understood that he was here for LET business. And then they talked about Khalid warning him about the goggles being discovered in New York, and to be careful during that same conversation in the driveway, the three of them.
Is that 159 of the appendix?
That's 159 of this joint appendix.
Okay, Your Honor.
Take a look at that. Why doesn't that support what the district court found?
Because he never explained his assumption or why it or its basis.
He had a conversation, he said, with the three of them in the driveway.
But he didn't say what the conversation was. He just said we talked. And I came to this conclusion for unknown reasons.
I understood he was here on LET business.
That was what he, but he never explained why he thought that, and LET was never mentioned.
Exact words, it was mentioned in the, well, I just read it there, but it's all right.
Morning, Your Honors. Your Honors, the district court concluded in this case that the terrorism enhancement applied. In making that conclusion, the district court determined that the defendant committed these offenses with the intent to influence or affect government conduct and thereby promote a federal crime of terrorism.
Well, the district court made a lot of factual findings. Many of them, I would say, mirror the statement of facts that you put forth, the government put forth. The district court didn't make many conclusory or explanatory findings, did it?
Well, I can't
find a single explanation. Maybe you can point me to where that would be.
Sure, Judge, I'd be happy to, because I think the judge did make a number of conclusions and then...
He certainly found a lot of facts, but what I'm looking for is an explanation.
Okay, sure.
Attachment, a link between those facts and the sentence.
All right, and I would direct the court to page 847 of the joint appendix. This is the March 11th hearing. The district court made the finding that Chandia knew that Muhammad Ajmal Khan was an LET leader. And he said specifically, Chandia did numerous things to help Khan. He knew he was working for the LET. Chandia knew he was an operative. The defendant met and came to know Khan and for nearly a period of 2 years provided material support to Khan. At the end of that recitation at page 853, he said he knew he was an LET leader. And then he... Again, that's an inference the judge drew from the facts, and then he cited a number of facts to support that inference. And these are all from page 847 of the joint appendix.
Right. Maybe I didn't make my question clear. I understand that the district court made a lot of factual findings. And as I say, I think they pretty closely mirror what the government's proposed factual findings were. What I was looking for was a rationale for tying the bow, for saying why these factual findings would lead him to come to the conclusion that we directed had to be made on remand.
Right, well, I think he did that.
Remember, what was it that we said had to be done on remand?
Well, I think the factual finding had to be, it had to be done more explicitly. And one of the things that actually was talked about in the last appeal was this issue about Muhammad Ajmal Khan being a known LET leader. And the question was, well, was there a finding that Chandia knew that? It's fine to say that, but was there a finding that Chandia knew that? The district court judge explicitly said that he knew...
Didn't we say that you had to show specific intent to affect the conduct of the government by intimidation?
Exactly.
There had to be findings that made that. And what I'm looking at is I see factual findings, but I don't see any rationale. And are what you're relying on... Just tell me what you rely on for the rationale. That would be very helpful to me.
Well, I think the rationale is the explicit inferences the judge drew from the evidence in the case.
Okay,
so
where does he say that?
For example, he says at page 850...
He's reciting all the facts there. Where does he draw, where does he say, and from this, I infer this?
Well, I'll direct you to the end of the March 11th hearing. After he had said Chandia's intent when he went to the LET office was to train and fight, after he said he knew about the September 16th meeting, the district court judge says, and this is page 853, again, it is clear the defendant knew LET was an organization that engaged in repeated acts of violence against the government of India, that the defendant knew that Muhammad Ajmal Khan was an LET leader, and that the defendant, in his actions here and in his support, intended to influence or affect government conduct by intimidation or coercion or to retaliate. So again...
Yeah, that's the sentence I found, too. That's the sentence.
Right.
You have to hang your hat on that.
Well, no, Judge, I think that's the conclusion after the judge made a number of very strong inferences of the defendant's intent.
He made factual findings, copying from what you all had submitted.
Well, Judge, he certainly recited facts from the record, but I would submit that the judge drew a number of inferences of the defendant's mens rea from those facts. The fact that he found, based on the facts, that his intent when he went to that LET office was not a coincidence. It wasn't happenstance. That his intent when he went there, where his other friends went, was to go train and fight. I would submit that when he talked about the paintball shipment that Chandia helped Muhammad Ajmal Khan get into his hands in Pakistan, he specifically said, and this is at page 849. I'm sorry. When he described that shipment, Your Honor, he said...
What page are you on?
Let me find it, Judge. I want to make sure I get it exactly right. This is 852 to 853. This is involving the shipment. The judge said, after Khan flew to Pakistan to meet the shipment, he could not get it through customs initially. Chandia once again took charge of the shipment and made sure that it could be released to LET. So again, the judge made the inference that in helping Muhammad Ajmal Khan, he was getting this. This is not some unwitting assistant, but rather he was getting this released to LET, to a foreign terrorist organization. That's another fact that the judge relied on in determining that he had the mens rea for the terrorism enhancement, that he had this intent to influence or affect government conduct. And again, Your Honors, the facts that the judge relied on and articulated at sentencing are reviewed under a clear error standard. And as the Supreme Court in Anderson versus Bessemer City said, if there are two inferences that can be drawn from the facts, it can't be clear error to choose one of those two inferences. And I would submit here, Judge, we have the district court judge making a number of findings, citing to a number of facts for the inference that he drew and the mens rea that he concluded. On the other side, we really do not have a plausible argument on behalf of the defense. I mean, Mr. Miller was up here earlier making a number of arguments about why he claims the enhancement should not apply. And I would submit to this court that these are incredibly implausible arguments. Let me go through some of these, and I'll talk about the judge's response to them. His appearance in this LET office that Masood Khan, Young Kwan, Hassan, and Atik all ended up in, he describes as happenstance, just a coincidence that he was there. When Muhammad Ajmal Khan ordered $17,000 worth of Kevlar in the United States, the defense simply claims that Chandia didn't have anything to do with that. That was just the family's computer. When Muhammad Ajmal Khan flew to the United States and listed Chandia's phone number as his contact number, the defense simply claims that he was just doing a favor for Masood Khan and he didn't know anything about Muhammad Ajmal Khan. This was some stranger to him. In that June 9, 2002 email about the brothers and the situation, and if everything got shut, the defense claims that that was simply a request to find out about whether the situation in Pakistan and India had gotten very dangerous. And again, at page 849 of the joint appendix, the judge said, when describing that email, he said, that email demonstrated that he was much more than an unwitting assistant to Muhammad Ajmal Khan. On at least two occasions, somebody logged in at the Dar al-Huda school where the defendant worked using Muhammad Ajmal Khan's login information. And in response, the defense simply argues that there was a lot of hacking going on at the school and somebody else must have done that. Again, an incredibly implausible argument about how that came to be. And the defense also argued that LET, although it's a foreign terrorist organization, and although it was involved in terrorist activity well before its designation, that it's somehow a charitable organization. But if you look at the entire record in this case, they can point to no document, nothing from the defendant's computer, his car, anywhere else, where it shows an interest in LET's charitable purposes. What we see is the defendant's interested in training and fighting, and he has information about LET's violent aims. So if you take all these arguments, which again, we would argue are completely implausible, if you credit them, the defendant wouldn't even be guilty of the crimes with which he was charged. And the judge recognized that. He said, and this is at page 742 of the appendix, during the January 28th hearing, he said, the jury didn't buy that either. So clearly, the district court judge recognized that this was a rehash of the unsuccessful arguments from trial. The defense was now making those same arguments to convince the judge that the defendant did not have the mens rea for the terrorism enhancement. And the judge said, the jury didn't buy that either, and I don't buy that. I'm not convinced by that. Instead, looking at all these facts that he identified and laid out in a very coherent fashion, the judge said, and again, here we have a district court judge trying to determine the mens rea for the terrorism enhancement. So it's the defendant's specific intent. And he has to be able to look at facts and draw inferences from those facts. And we believe that especially in the March 11th hearing, but we would also say in the January 28th hearing, when he resolved all the objections to the PSR and ended up with a PSR that said the terrorism enhancement applied, it set forth the correct elements for the terrorism enhancement, it had a supplemental appendix with four additional pages of facts demonstrating that the terrorism enhancement applied, that record taken as a whole demonstrates that the district court judge had determined the defendant had the mens rea, and he identified a great deal of evidence to support that finding. And again, back to the Bessemer City case, it's a clearly erroneous standard. And just because another finder of fact may have reached a different conclusion, or even if this court, had it been in the district court judge's shoes, would have reached a different conclusion, it's not reversible unless this district court can say, or this court can say to the district court, given all those facts, we find that you were clearly erroneous in the facts you relied on and the conclusions you reached. And I would submit to this court that the record is very strong. There's not a plausible alternative to the conclusion the district court reached.
Okay, anything further?
Well, Your Honors, I just
want to... Let me ask you about the allocution issue.
Sure.
What's your answer to that?
Asking the defendant whether he wanted to speak?
That's right.
Well, Judge, I think if you look at the record...
He has a right... You recognize that that has to be done.
I do, but I would submit that in this case it was done. First of all, there are a couple things I'd say. The January 28th hearing was originally scheduled as the sentencing hearing. There was no second hearing scheduled at that point. The parties believed that the sentencing would take place that day. Mr. Miller had a number of people from the community that he pointed out. Mr. Miller made a number of the 3553 arguments at that hearing. Now, at the second hearing on March the 11th, the district court judge, as he was required to, asked the defendant if he had anything to say. The defendant said he didn't. It is true, in that record, the district court judge did not say to Mr. Miller, do you have anything you wish to say? But Mr. Miller spoke up, objected to the sentence that was imposed, indicated that he relied on all the previous pleadings that he had made. So although the district court judge did not specifically say the words, Mr. Miller, do you have anything you wish to say? He did get up and speak. So the effect was the same. And
that was the sequence as you related it. Mr. Miller spoke after the judge had asked the defendant and he had replied in the negative.
Correct. And I can find that for you.
March 11th?
It was at the March 11th hearing, correct. Actually, I don't believe I have that in front, but it was the end of the March 11th hearing. It's about the last page of the hearing. And it was after the district court judge had asked Mr. Chandia if he wanted to say anything. And at that point, Mr. Miller did stand up, objected, said he relied on what had previously been filed. And there was about a half a page left of the transcript.
Was there any objection to the on allocution procedures or anything?
No, there was not, Judge.
So anything we have on that is plain error review?
Exactly, Judge. Yeah, the objection was to the sentence itself. It was not to the failure to...
Page 854 is what you're talking about. Mr. Shandia, would you come to the podium? Is there anything you want to say at this time? Defendant, no. Court, all right. And then the court went and did the sentencing. Is that what you're referring to? Top of page 854.
Actually, Judge, I was referring to page 855.
Where Mr. Miller talks.
Pretty close.
Exactly. Mr. Miller, Your Honor, we will obviously, for the record, note our exception to the court's ruling and finding a fact. We adopt what was filed before. He said you have an exception to everything I do.
Well, that's to the whether it was objected to.
Because he was worried about the lawyer.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough.
And, you know, if I could just wrap up briefly, unless, I mean, there were a couple of other fairly tangential issues. I think that obviously the focus was the terrorism enhancement. Before I conclude, does the court have questions about any of the other issues that were raised? Your Honors, the defense in this case characterized the defendant as a gopher and a chauffeur. They argued that his convictions merely reflect unwise accommodation for material support. They've argued that his appearance at the same LET office that all of Tamimi's other disciples used to try to go train and fight was a mere coincidence, happenstance. But these explanations are completely contradicted by the evidence in this case. The district court recognized that these explanations were completely contradicted by the evidence in this case, and he rejected them. Instead, the district court pointed to ample evidence in the record to demonstrate that Shandia had the mens rea for the terrorism enhancement. He drew logical inferences from that evidence. And in engaging in this careful, fact-bound analysis, the sentencing judge committed no error of any sort in this case, let alone a clear error. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Gibbs. Mr. Miller?
If the court please, Mr. Hassan at page 159 says he came to an assumption which he never expressed, according to the evidence, to anyone. He never said why he thought that. We know two things that he knew that Shandia didn't know. He knew that he had met Mack in Pakistan, Muhammad Ajmal Khan. He knew then, because he was with LET, that is Hassan was, that Mack was with LET also. So he knew those two facts. And he knew the third fact that he was here in the U.S. He never mentioned, according to him, and the government didn't ask for an explanation or an explication of it at any time. So he didn't say that he's here from LET. I know you're here for LET. They claimed earlier that he had made the statement that you're here for LET in Mr. Shandia's presence, but the record doesn't show that because it didn't happen. So he comes to a conclusion for reasons of his own, which he doesn't explain and doesn't articulate. It's not rational that Mr. Shandia came to the same conclusion because of what Mr. Hassan thought based on what Mr. Hassan knew that wasn't known to Shandia. It's also like the testimony from their witnesses, like Coleman, their expert, about the June email, because it wasn't a conflict. They were on the verge of nuclear war. England pulled all of its people out of Pakistan. Japan pulled all of its people out of Pakistan. Colin Powell got directly involved, and the government can't rise above their own experts' testimony about that they were right at the brink of nuclear war, so he sends an email, I understand everything got shut, and that's what it relates to. In it, he asks for the phone number, which he doesn't get. If you look at what happens when the court says that the paintballs got released, they didn't. Mr. Gibbs and if I had the Rule 32 opportunity, that the word is must, I would have pointed to page 27 of the oral argument here, where he said to this court that they had no idea what happened to the paintballs after they got to the office, and there's no evidence they ever left the office. And in a property damage conspiracy, which is what we have here, what is he going to do? No paintball guns, throw paintballs that are water-soluble at a building that is owned by the Indian government and take a hose and wash it off? That's a terrorism enhancement? The judge didn't... deal with that issue. In the September 16th meeting, the judge said he was told about the meeting. I defy anybody living in the world to find a single syllable that shows that he was told about that meeting anywhere in the record of this case from day one, ever. And what did Kwan say, the government witness? He says, we didn't let him know. He wasn't involved. We kept it to ourselves. We kept it quiet. And you look through everything. You won't find a word. The judge made a finding. No facts in the record. The judge didn't explain how the facts that he found led to specific intent. Specific intent should be by clear and convincing evidence, because it is not an act. I used a gun, the guy was a cop. Or like in Grubbs, where the defendant was in, had other victims, and they brought in other victims that weren't on trial to increase his level. If you look at the O'Brien case, it talks about severity of sentence, and you go from 63 to 70 months to 360 to life, criminal history 1 to 6. It ought to be clear and convincing. The judge didn't say what standard he used. He didn't point to, he made conclusions, but they're not supported by the record. He did talk about providing material support, which happened. He was convicted of it. But that's not a basis for this enhancement. The defendant has to have done something to evidence his specific intent. Two of the facts the court found were just not supported by the record, two of the conclusions they made, that the court made, the key conclusions. The government didn't go outside the record. They didn't bring in anybody from Pakistan to show what happened. They didn't bring back Hassan, explain what you meant and what was that conversation. They didn't bring back Kwan, tell us about the conversation in the office. The office conversation in November is before he's doing anything other than being in the office. Kwan's there, has no concept of Urdu, doesn't even know what's being said. So the court can make findings, which it did, but the findings have to have a basis in the record. And I just learned this morning about this court's decision in Bell. It was in Lawyers Weekly, and I happened to look at it this morning. And in Bell, you talked about what you said, which, Your Honor, which is that how the facts relate to the finding. I haven't cited that because I didn't read it until 8 o'clock this morning. But I just happened to carry my Lawyers Weekly with me. I'm obsessive or something. I don't know. But the point of it is there was no connection. And in the last decision, this court said, find the facts and explain how. In Bell, this court said the court didn't explain how. And there is no explanation of how. And the court said that the meeting was known. It wasn't. The court said that he was there to attend the camps. There's no evidence of that at all. Everybody involved with it said he wasn't like that. He wasn't that way. That's what the government witnesses said. The government can't arise above their own witnesses. They considered him not to be somebody like that, which is why they cut him out of that group. Why were they in Lahore? The government evidence was that Shandia was there because that's where his father lived, and that's what one of the witnesses for the government, Hassan, said. Why was Hassan in Lahore with Kwan and with Masood Khan? Because Hassan's family lived there, and he visited the family before he went off. Now, if Shandia was going to go to camp to go to war, why would he take a University of Maryland course and continue with it online in Lahore and complete it while he's there? You don't do that when you're going off to war to combat, or going to a training camp, or going to Camp Lejeune or Fort Benning for infantry school. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. I notice you're court appointed. I do. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
I do want to recognize that service. It's an important service, and thank you very much.
Yes, Your Honor. So
we'll come down and greet counsel and then take a short recess.
The court will take a brief recess.